Today is Monday, September 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, what now after the U.S. cancels talks with the Taliban?
Any talk or any talks that does not guarantee an end to Taliban violence will be meaningless to continue.
Also ahead, Boris Johnson continues his push to take Britain out of the EU. And the UN's nuclear watchdog agency says its inspectors confirm Iran is installing more centrifuges to refine uranium. Those stories and more are next. The revelation that planned peace talks with the Taliban leaders and Afghan President Ashraf Ghani at Camp David and the cancellation of those meetings are the latest of U.S. President Donald Trump's unconventional foreign policy moves. While U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Sunday that Trump made the right decision to call off peace talks with Taliban leaders at his presidential retreat because of the terrorist group's ongoing attacks in Afghanistan, lawmakers from both parties said the meeting at the presidential retreat outside Washington should never have been planned. Democrat New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez called it another example of the Trump administration's foreign policy, which is a high-wire act that ultimately is focused on Trump as a persona, but not on the strategic, methodological effort to creating peace.
We have serious concerns. Number one is you can't have peace unless you have the Taliban and the Afghan government together. This has been a one-sided talk. And secondly, I don't know how you bring the perpetrator, or those who gave refuge to the perpetrator of September 11th as we approach the 18th anniversary, to Camp David when they're in the midst of conducting attacks which recently created the death of an American.
To unpack these developments, Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger, an Air Force pilot who was serving in Iraq and Afghanistan before winning his seat in the House, said on Twitter, quote, "Never should leaders of a terrorist organization that hasn't renounced 9/11 and continue to be evil be allowed in our great country. Never. Full stop." Speaking in Kabul on Sunday, Ghani's spokesperson, Sadiq Siddiqui, said continuing with peace talks would be meaningless as long as the Taliban continues to commit violent atrocities.
So our position has been very strong and firm in that. The president has been very clear in the past so many months to see how we can actually end this violence. So if the Taliban are not committed, if there is contradiction in what they say and what they do in Afghanistan, so we would not only doubt that process, but we will raise concerns about that process, like the people have already done that.
Earlier, I spoke with Jeff M. Smith, research fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Asia Studies Center. I began our conversation by asking Jeff what he made out of the criticism on President Trump.
I have to say the invitation and really the entire process was quite unexpected. We've known that the U.S. has been negotiating with the Taliban for many months now directly through a special representative, Khalilzad. We've known that we've been getting close to a tentative agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban that would ideally open the way for intra-Afghan negotiations, but I don't think many people were expecting a signing ceremony at Camp David, so I have to say it caught most of us by surprise. It's understandable, in my opinion, that there are criticism emerging over the optics of hosting the Taliban at Camp David on the week of 9/11. Obviously, the president and those who were organizing this meeting thought that they would have a positive, optimistic message to come from such an arrangement. They thought we were on the verge of signing an agreement and that, this would not have been controversial had it gone well.
What do you mean by that? Because there was some pushback on the deal itself, the withdrawal of U.S. troops, no firm commitments for a ceasefire, only the promise that Afghanistan wouldn't be used as a staging ground for attacks against the United States.
Correct. This was very much an interim deal. And in fact, as I've argued, this was in some ways the easiest part. We've had relative agreement with the Taliban on the outlines of a U.S.-Taliban deal, I would even argue for many years now. The Taliban have been sort of informally pledging not to host international terrorist groups or anyone targeting the United States in exchange for a withdrawal of U.S. troops. In principle, we've agreed on this for a long time, frankly. The toughest part of any negotiation has always been getting the Taliban to sit down in negotiations with the Afghan government, something they have firmly resisted for the entire duration of the conflict. What had given some people hope is that as we've inched forward with this interim U.S.-Taliban deal, the Taliban did seem to begin walking back from their staunch opposition to negotiating with the Afghan government, which was always the end goal.
So what do you see as the road to get to inter-Afghan, talks?
Well, this was the path forward.
But it's not there anymore.
Well, I think first we need to have a new Afghan government in place, because one of the things that concerned me about the current framework for U.S.-Taliban negotiations was that many of our Afghan partners felt that they had been cut out, that they had been left out. And then a real meeting of the minds between U.S. and Afghan officials on how best to proceed in tandem. But I think right now the U.S. priority needs to be on propping up and stabilizing the Afghan government and Afghan security forces.
Jeff M. Smith is a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Asia Studies Center. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar on Monday explained what the removal of the border backstop would mean during Brexit.
In the absence of agreed alternative arrangements, no backstop is no deal for us. All it does is kick the can down the road for another 14 months. Another 14 months of uncertainty for business, another 14 months of uncertainty for people north and south of the border. So that's not an option that we find attractive at all.
Speaking along Varadkar, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that failing to reach a deal over Brexit would be a failure of statecraft, and that he was bringing ideas on ways to resolve the Irish border backstop issue. But
of course, we must get Brexit done, because the UK must come out on October the 31st, by October the 31st, or else I fear that permanent damage will be done in the UK to trust in our democratic system.
Also today in the House of Commons, Speaker John Bercow says that he will step down by the end of next month after a decade on the job. But where do things stand now as Parliament moves into suspension at the end of the day? For that, I'm joined on the phone by reporter Henry Ridgewell. Henry, welcome to the program. Henry, are you there?
Yes, Steve. Hi. Good to be with you.
So Parliament is going to be suspended at the end of the day. Last week we were talking about these bills moving forward to prevent a no-deal Brexit. Where are things going?
Yes, that's right. Parliament is due to be suspended at the close of business today, although it must be said there's important business going on right now before that happens. To update you on, though, that law to prevent a no-deal Brexit, that did receive royal assent, as we call it, this afternoon. So that is now law in the United Kingdom. So theoretically, according to that law, Britain cannot leave the European Union without a deal on October the 31st.
Does that mean that Boris Johnson would prevent him, as he has said, he'd rather die in a ditch than roll things down the line?
Exactly. So this is where we just don't know what is going to happen from here. Between a rock and a hard place, we've got this law now preventing Britain from leaving with no deal on October the 31st. But then again, the chances of Britain striking a deal with Europe before that date appear extremely slim, given the two sides are so far apart and given the fact that Parliament is about to be suspended. So there will be no scrutiny of government business for the next 5 weeks. And so any particular deal seems very unlikely at the moment. So we have this extraordinary situation where we have Parliament not sitting, no MPs in Parliament, and yet Britain is seemingly on a precipice.
Boris Johnson lost the working majority last week in Parliament, and there have been talks about him trying to get a snap election. What are the prospects of having an election sometime this year?
sometime this year would seem very likely, but before that October the 31st deadline now seems very unlikely. This afternoon, within the next couple of hours in Parliament, we're expecting a vote on an election brought forward by the government, an election to be held around October 16th or 17th, ahead of that deadline, but opposition parties say they will vote against it. And as you mentioned, Boris Johnson doesn't have a majority anymore, so he will lose that vote. And then we go into the suspension of Parliament, and no further votes on an election can be held. And so by the time Parliament returns in mid-October, they could have a vote on an election then, but we need an election campaign period of at least 5 weeks. So the next date we're looking at is late November.
How is it that he is able to remain prime minister since he no longer has that working majority?
Yes, it seems extraordinary, doesn't it? A prime minister who can't get any business done at all. And this is really sums up the constitutional crisis that Britain finds itself in. The truth is that the government has not really done any business for the last 2 or 3 years since the Brexit referendum. It has been solely focused on this deal. It has been blocked by Parliament, and now, without a majority, Boris Johnson's government simply will find it very, very difficult to get anything done, hence his keenness to have an election as soon as possible. The opposition parties are holding out until Boris Johnson does go to Europe and ask for an extension, as this new law stipulates, and then they say once that extension is secured with the European Union, then they will vote for an election and we can go to the polls. The one snag in that is that there's no guarantee at the moment that the European Union will agree to an extension, with particularly France saying if Britain is just going to waste the next 3 months of that extension and we'll be back here in January 2020, there's no point. We're better off with Britain out of the club.
Henry Ridgewell is in London. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
The UN's nuclear watchdog agency said on Monday its inspectors confirmed Iran is installing more advanced centrifuges that can be used to refine uranium. The International Atomic Energy said the equipment includes several types of centrifuges prohibited under the 2015 nuclear deal Iran reached with a group of world powers that limited its nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. It was the latest step Iran has taken away from its nuclear agreement as it complains European nations are not doing enough to help Iran's oil sector deal with U.S. sanctions. U.S. President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the agreement, saying it was inadequate. Among other top stories in the world, officials in northern Burkina Faso say at least 29 people were killed in two separate incidents Sunday. Russian voters handed setbacks to Kremlin-affiliated candidates in Moscow and other local elections nationwide, losses that came despite a near-total ban on opposition candidates that sparked a summer of street protests and mass arrests in the capital. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and with our mobile application. This is VOA News.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the biggest threat to President Yoweri Museveni's re-election in 2021 may be a 37-year-old musician. The future of Uganda on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
The VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Hong Kong activist Joshua Wong was released from police custody Monday after being arrested at Hong Kong International Airport for breaching bail conditions. Local media reported Wong was detained Sunday after returning home from a trip to Taiwan. Wong told media after a Monday morning court appearance that he believed his arrest was tied to the chaos that occurred during a mass rally Sunday when protesters wreaked havoc on Hong Kong's central business district.
So unfortunately, with the political prosecution, no one would love it would happen. But with the chaos happened yesterday, I've been detained for 24 hours. And I urge international communities to realize the political prosecution just result in white terror and become a common norm.
Wong was arrested in August when he was charged with inciting and participating in an unauthorized assembly. His statement came as thousands of students formed human chains outside schools across Hong Kong to push for democratic reforms after violent weekend clashes in the semi-autonomous Chinese territory.
Fight for freedom! Fight for freedom!
High school and university students held hands for a second week to form human chains that snaked into the streets outside their schools before the bell rang. On the Waterloo Road in Yau Ma Tei area of Kowloon, students in uniform and protesters wearing black also chanted five key demands, not one less. It has become the slogan of protesters who refuse to yield until all of their demands have been met. The five demands are the complete withdrawal of the proposed extradition bill, which has been met, the government to withdraw the use of the word riot in relation to protests, the unconditional release of arrested protesters and charges against them dropped, an independent inquiry into police behavior, and implementation of genuine universal suffrage. On Sunday, thousands of demonstrators marched to the U.S. consulate in Hong Kong, urging U.S. President Donald Trump to liberate their city as they press for more democratic freedom in the semi-autonomous Chinese territory. Panzer Chan organized the march. Sorry, we don't appear to have the audio. But protesters on Sunday urged Washington to pass a bill known as the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act to support their cause. The bill proposes sanctions against Hong Kong and Chinese officials found to suppress democracy and human rights in the city, and could also affect Hong Kong's preferential trade status with the United States. Hong Kong police fired tear gas to disperse protesters in the upmarket Causeway Bay shopping district Sunday after demonstrators had rallied outside that U.S. consulate. The United Nations estimates some 70,000 people, many of them children, are in need of food, clean water, and shelter. The UN Children's Fund has sent 1.5 tons of life-saving humanitarian aid thus far to the Bahamas. International Edition's Lori London spoke with UNICEF Regional Emergency Specialist Hanok Barlevy about relief efforts.
It's very much for water and sanitation equipment identified by the government as the immediate needs. And obviously, we're always looking at water, sanitation, and food as the first response to any emergency. So in this case, the idea was to give all this stuff immediately, as quickly as possible. And we hope to get this stuff to the Abaco Island very soon. One of the things we want to avoid additional diseases, and so obviously that people have water. So it is from jerrycan, from small household jerrycan to big bladders, big tanks, water treatment, and that kind of stuff. So it is to household, community, and also water treatment at the same time.
Have you had a chance to speak with relief people on the ground there who have been able to describe what they are experiencing?
We are also constantly on the ground there also. We are back and forth all the time. Yesterday, we have spent all day in Abaco, and we're also speaking to different other agencies. We are going together as a complementary interagency mission, and also the way we are working, we are very much complementing each other. And other relief that's already on the ground, but also to keep in mind that many people slowly have been evacuated. So this is something that we also have to factor this. While we are supporting children and their families in Abaco, the number is getting smaller, and we also have to locate on the other island where people are going. Few of them are going to their relatives, but few of them don't have relatives or don't have the means to get temporary solutions. So we are working working with the government to ensure that children and their families getting the immediate needs for their well-being. People still quite shocked and terrified by the event. The devastation is enormous. Everything is just gone, collapsed. Mm. Many houses, many facilities, electricity, everything. Imagine that in a second, a child losing both parents or one of the parents. We found few children that, not few, quite few of them, that lost relatives or even their immediate parents. They're still kind of trying to bring the pieces together at this stage. So that's why we're also looking at how to work on how to support psychosocial kind of treatment for children, and mainly children, but also to their parents, to the older community. The people are quite traumatized and left without anything. That's the image that you have to realize, that you are staying in a glimpse of a second without anything. You're home, and in a second, you don't have it.
What about the children? That is UNICEF's, of course, number one focus. Any idea how many children that you are needing to respond to, or is it still too soon and chaotic to really have those kinds of numbers?
Working with the government here, and we know numbers of children in total, and from both islands, we're also looking at Abaco and the Grand Bahama, of around total exposed around 10,000 children. And among them, with their groups that are more vulnerable, and probably we will be able to narrow down. But at the moment, we're looking at 10,000 children that have been exposed to the hurricane, and then from this we will have to start to identify the most vulnerable ones, ones that lost their parents, ones that lost their house. There are different categories of vulnerability that we are now working with the government to identify and to ensure that we are addressing as much as possible different needs so they can come back to some sort of normality as much as one can say.
That was UNICEF Regional Emergency Specialist Hanok Barlevy, speaking to our own Lori London, and you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
An extensive new study brings troubling news for people who consume two or more soft drink servings a day. The study, which was coordinated by the International Agency for Research on Cancer, found people who drink two or more glasses of soda each day, compared to those who drink no more than one soft drink per month, had a higher risk of death from a wide range of causes. For those of you who think you're safe because you drink sugar-free beverages, sorry, but the research suggests it doesn't matter if you're drinking soft drinks sweetened with sugar or with artificial sweeteners. The mortality risks are the same. Specifically, the study authors found that drinking two or more glasses of artificially sweetened soft drinks per day was positively linked to deaths from cardiovascular disease, while consuming one or more glasses of sugar-sweetened soft drinks each day was positively associated with deaths from digestive diseases. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. North Korea said Monday it's willing to resume nuclear diplomacy with the United States in late September, but only if the U.S. comes to the negotiating table with satisfactory new proposals. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was optimistic about the possibility of talks on Sunday when he appeared on ABC's This Week.
We know Chairman Kim has continued to make the commitment to denuclearize. We are hopeful that in the coming days or perhaps weeks, we'll be back at the negotiating table with them. That's the best outcome. It's the best outcome for the North Korean people. President Trump has made a commitment to their security and economic prosperity.
Negotiations aimed at dismantling Pyongyang's nuclear and missile programs have stalled since the collapse of a second summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in the Vietnamese capital of Hanoi in February. North Korea has fired several short-range missiles in recent weeks in protest against U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises and the adoptions of new weapons, complicating the reopening of the talks. And with that, that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Mungane, engineer John Dryden, and managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, thank you so much for listening. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at voanews.com. And don't forget, with our mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Make it a great day.